So our passage this morning is Acts chapter 15, verses 36 to 41, the second passage that we read earlier on in our service. Now everyone agrees then on the events that are narrated in this passage, that Paul and Barnabas are planning a rerun of their earlier missionary journey, that Barnabas wants to take Mark along again, but Paul doesn't, and that the two men end up separating over this issue. Everyone agrees on that sequence of events. And judging by the literature, or most of the literature that I've read, most people also agree how we as readers should respond to this passage. We should shake our heads sadly over it. We should feel rather as we felt on Monday evening, as Maria Sharapova gave that press conference. We should mutter to ourselves that even the greatest Christians ultimately have feet of clay. We should find the passage unsavory. It should leave a bad taste in our mouths. Most seem to agree that that's how we should respond to the passage. But I don't take that line. It seems to me that if Luke wanted to produce that response in us, he could have done a much better job of it. And I think then that it's okay for us to be upbeat and undismayed in the face of Paul and Barnabas's separation here, and I simply want to suggest four reasons why. Reason number one then, it's a disagreement, not a fight. It's a disagreement, not a fight. So Luke doesn't say then that at any point Paul embarked on a campaign to blacken Barnabas's reputation and name, to turn the church in Antioch against his colleague. He didn't start spreading scurrilous stories about Barnabas. Well, you know, he may look the real deal, but I've spent hours with him, weeks with him out on the road, and, you know, he's not all he seems. He entertains some heretical ideas, and he has issues with drink and a weakness for women. He's not the real deal. Paul didn't spread stories like that. Luke doesn't say that at any point Barnabas wrote off Paul as a fellow Christian, crossing his name off his daily prayer list and deleting any of Paul's sermons that he had on his iPod. Luke doesn't say that at any point Paul lost control and physically lunged at Barnabas or aimed a blow at his face or unleashed a tirade of abuse and foul language at him. Luke doesn't say that at any point Barnabas got hold of Mark and frog-marched him down to the nearest solicitor's office and got him to file a lawsuit against Paul for unfair dismissal. No, if Luke had recorded any of that kind of thing, then of course we would have good reason for shaking our heads sadly. That's precisely the kind of behavior that Paul himself so often prohibits in his later epistles. While there is jealousy and strife among you, are you not of the flesh and behaving only in a human way? 1 Corinthians 3, verse 3. Brother goes to law against brother, and that before unbelievers. Why not rather suffer wrong? Why not rather be defrauded? 1 Corinthians 6, 6 and 7. I fear that when I come, I may find you not as I wish, that perhaps there may be quarreling, jealousy, anger, hostility, slander, gossip, conceit, and disorder. 2 Corinthians 12, 20. Now the works of the flesh are enmity, strife, jealousy, fits of anger, rivalries, dissensions, divisions. Galatians 5, 19 and 20. So when believers are acting unlovingly toward one another, when believers are assaulting other believers, whether their bodies or their property or their reputations or their dignity, when there's disrespect and ill will, yes, of course, that's unacceptable. That flies in the face of the gospel itself, which is a gospel of peace and reconciliation. And there's no category of misconduct which the New Testament takes more seriously than that category of misconduct. And so if Luke had charged Paul and or Barnabas with Corinthian-like behavior here, with the works of the flesh in Galatians 5 terms, then this would indeed be a distressing passage, but he doesn't. There are no points of contact between the account of this separation and those grim vice lists that we have later on in the New Testament. No, this is a disagreement, but it's not a fight. Now you might be thinking, well, okay, that makes sense, but surely just the very fact that they ended up separating at all, surely that in itself is problematic. They disagree, and okay, they don't get into a fight with slander and factions and all that expressly prohibited stuff. But shouldn't one of them here just concede to the other? Shouldn't Paul say, okay, I don't think it's sensible, but we'll take Mark with us and we'll stay together? Or shouldn't Barnabas say, okay, I don't think it's fair, but we'll leave Mark behind and we'll stay together? Wouldn't that have been the proper Christian thing to do? Isn't the separation itself wrong here? Well, 2 points in that connection. First of all, there's no issue of authority here. There's no issue of authority here. You know how in some of life's key relationships then, God has invested a certain party within that relationship with authority. So the relationship between a husband and wife, the relationship between an elder and church member, the relationship between a governor and a citizen. And in such relationships then, the party without the authority is bound at times to concede to the party with that God-given authority in non-moral issues, like the one that we're dealing with here. This isn't a moral issue, is it? Because God hasn't anywhere said, oh, Mark must go on this missionary journey, or Mark must not go on this missionary journey. And so this isn't a moral issue. Of course, where it is a moral issue, where God has legislated, then the person without the authority can't concede to the one with the authority, because that would be disobeying God. But as I say, the party without the authority in those relationships will at times need to concede to the party with the authority on non-moral issues. But here that principle's irrelevant. Because in this partnership of Paul and Barnabas, neither has authority over the other. It's almost as if Luke, in fact, has been deliberately flagging that fact up in preparation for this moment, the way in which back in chapter 14, verse 14, he is referred to both men as apostles. It's not the apostle Paul and Barnabas, it's the apostles Barnabas and Paul. And then the other thing, of course, the way in which, beginning there, Luke has now this kind of vein of swapping the order of the names. So there it's Barnabas and Paul, but you go to chapter 15, verse 2, and it's Paul and Barnabas, and then verse 12 of chapter 15, and it's Barnabas and Paul again, and then verse 22, and it's Paul and Barnabas again, and then verse 25, and it's Barnabas and Paul again, and he keeps swapping then the order of the names, I think probably to emphasize this point. Neither of them has authority over the other, and so neither here is bound to concede to the other when there's this disagreement. So that's one important point. There's no issue of authority. But the other, even more important point, is that we are talking here about separation for the purpose of a missionary journey. We're talking here about separation for the purpose of a missionary journey. We mustn't compare this to the situation you have when there's a disagreement within a church and one bunch of people within the church ends up separating from the others in the church and setting up another church down the road somewhere. I mean, that's tragic, isn't it, when that happens? That's those Christians saying, well, we don't belong together. We can't exist together. We're not part of the same family. And you have all the local people in that town or city, and they see these two groups then meeting in two different locations in the same street, no longer having anything to do with each other. And they say, well, they're a quarrelsome lot, aren't they, these Christians? And that's tragic when that happens. But that's not what we're talking about here. That's an invalid analogy. Because these two men, then, they're not dissociating from each other. There's no rupture here of Christian fellowship and fraternity. I mean, much is made, isn't it, often, of the fact that Luke never again mentions Barnabas. But that's not that big a deal. He never again mentions Peter either, as we saw last week. And actually, it's almost certain that Paul and Barnabas did work together again after this point. So in 1 Corinthians chapter 9, verse 6, Paul there, he's defending himself against certain accusations from the Corinthians. He says in verse 5, "Don't we have the right to take along a believing wife, as do the other apostles and the brothers of the Lord and Cephas? Or is it only Barnabas and I who have no right to refrain from working for a living?" So Paul there assumes that the Corinthians are aware of he and Barnabas as this kind of duo who have this tendency to support themselves on their missionary journeys. Now, if in fact they haven't worked together since that first missionary journey in Acts 13 and 14, which was long before the gospel ever went to Corinth, then this reference to Barnabas and I would be utterly lost on the Corinthians. And so it seems almost certain that Paul and Barnabas did work together again, and of course we know that Paul and Mark worked together in the future. Colossians 4:10, 2 Timothy 4:11, and Philemon 24 tell us that. So there's no rupture of Christian fellowship and fraternity here. This is simply a practical solution to a disagreement as to how this one missionary journey is to be conducted. They can take Mark with them and Paul will be on tenterhooks the whole time. They can leave Mark behind and Barnabas will be distracted the whole time, worrying how this is affecting the young man back home. Or there's this third option. They can separate and Paul won't be on tenterhooks and Barnabas won't be distracted. And it's a practical solution then to this disagreement as to how this one missionary journey should be conducted. And so this, I'm saying, is the first reason why, as readers, we can be upbeat and undismayed in the face of this separation. It's a disagreement, not a fight. In fact, we can put it more positively than that. Isn't it great that these two men can disagree, and disagree seriously, without it degenerating into a fight? There was an article in the Daily Telegraph the other week entitled "The Celebrity Feuds of Donald Trump." And the article catalogued then the very personal insults and put-downs that have littered Donald Trump's campaign trail. And so his goading then of the singer Cher about her massive plastic surgeries that didn't work. His scorning of the film star Robert De Niro. "I like his acting, but you know we're not dealing here with Albert Einstein." His dismissal of the comedian Russell Brand as a major loser, and so on. And, you know, we may be more or less subtle in the way we do it, but actually it's instinctive, isn't it, to all of us in our fallen human nature to conduct our relationships Donald Trump style, with feuds and spats and ugly tactics. And here are Paul and Barnabas, and they've insisted, haven't they, back in chapter 14, verse 15, that we are men. Remember to that crowd in Lystra, we are men. They're not angels, they're not gods, they are human beings, ordinary human beings, and yet here they are, and they're not conducting their relationship Donald Trump style. They're disagreeing, but without getting nasty and combative in the process. How come? Well, that's the grace of God in their lives, isn't it? As they have trusted in the Lord Jesus Christ, God in his grace has, of course, changed their legal standing before him. He has forgiven them of their sins and acquitted them in his courts. But God, in his grace, hasn't just changed their legal standing, he's also changed their characters. Their behavior is no longer dictated by what fallen human nature is capable of. They can do better than that. They can go higher than that. They can conduct their relationships even when those relationships are complicated by by situations like this one with Mark, they can conduct their relationships with respect and with dignity and with love. They can disagree without getting into a fight. It's a wonderful thing. And it raises the question for us this morning. Do we know the grace of God in our lives? Has God changed our standing before him? Are we forgiven? But has he also changed our characters then? Is there this renovation of our characters going on whereby what is unnatural for us human beings is increasingly emerging in us, this ability to conduct relationships, not Donald Trump style, but Paul and Barnabas style? So that's the first thing then. It's a disagreement, not a fight. Second reason we can be upbeat and undismayed. It's variety, not confusion. It's variety, not confusion. So we've established then that it's a disagreement, not a fight, and of course that's good. It's good that they could disagree without resorting to personal attacks and all that kind of thing. But we might well think, well, okay, yes, but wouldn't it be even better if they didn't even disagree at all? It's great that they can kind of disagree and not fight, but wouldn't it be even better if they didn't even disagree in the first place? If there wasn't this kind of confusion as to whether Mark should come or whether he should stay, wouldn't it be better if these men just thought in exactly the same way? Their minds just worked on the same track. Would that not be vastly preferable? Well, at this point, I think we need to probe a little Paul and Barnabas' reasons for the positions that they took vis-a-vis Mark. So let's think about Paul first. And of course, Luke gives us significant hints, doesn't he, as to Paul's reason for not wanting to take Mark on this journey. So verse 38, Paul thought best not to take with them one who had withdrawn from them in Pamphylia and had not gone with them to the work. So we can surely infer from that in Paul's mind, Mark is a liability. Mark can't be relied upon. What if this expedition they're now embarking upon should prove tough? What if they should encounter persecution? What if their journeys should be disrupted by shipwreck or by bandits? What if food and drink and sleep should be in short supply? These missionary journeys were real tests of endurance. They weren't for the faint-hearted. How would Mark cope if this one then was plagued by difficulties? And so taking Mark along with the track record that he has, it just seems to Paul too risky. And that seems to be then his reason for not wanting to take him. And of course, underlying that is what we might call Paul's intensity of spirit. He's a driven man, isn't he, the Apostle Paul? He's a man who can combine, if necessary, a heavy pastoral and evangelistic schedule on the one hand with making tents to earn a living on the other hand. He's a man who can keep on teaching a congregation in Troas all the way through the hours of the night without flagging. He's a man who can claim in relation to all the other apostles, I worked harder than all of them. There's just this indefatigableness about the Apostle Paul. His foot is permanently on the gas, we might say. He's a driven man, and being wired up like that then, he struggles with the thought of taking along with them this weak link, or this potential weak link, John Mark. That's Paul. What about Barnabas? Well, Luke doesn't give us any hints in this passage as to why Barnabas wanted to take Mark. Those of a cynical bent will say it was pure nepotism, because of course Barnabas and Mark were cousins, And so some will say, well, that was the reason that Barnabas wanted to take him. But Luke can't intend us to suspect such a motive, because he never once informs us throughout his whole book of that familial tie between Barnabas and Mark. It's only in a verse in Colossians that we discover that. I think it's likely that Barnabas wanted Mark to come because he wanted to encourage this young man, and because beyond whatever it was that had caused Mark to desert last time, Barnabas saw signs of genuine potential in him. And I feel reasonably confident then in suggesting that those were Barnabas's reasons, despite Luke's silence in this passage, because we know what sort of a man Barnabas was generally, don't we? If Paul is characterized by an intensity of spirit, we might say Barnabas is characterized by a generosity of spirit. So that's why he's called Barnabas. His original name, of course, is Joseph, but he's called Barnabas in the church because he's a son of encouragement. He's the one sent to assess those first converts in Antioch, because he won't make superficial judgments about these Gentiles whose Christianity perhaps looks a bit different to the Christianity of the staid, conservative Jewish believers in Jerusalem. In other words, there's a pastoral sensitivity about this man. And so being wired up like that, Barnabas then struggles with the thought of leaving behind this precious soul, John Mark. And when we probe then where these two men, Paul and Barnabas, are coming from in this disagreement over Mark, I think it starts to look less like unsatisfactory confusion. Why can't they agree? Why can't they be on the same wavelength? And it starts to look much more like a quite healthy variety, actually. In fact, more than just a healthy variety, is this not a crucial variety that we see represented in the differences between Paul and Barnabas? Think about it. Think of Paul's intensity of spirit, as I've called it. And without that, of course, the gospel would never have advanced like it did in those middle decades of the first century. The message of Jesus would never have reached, would it, that impressive array of towns and cities and regions, without the stamina and the persistence and the sheer tireless exertion of the Apostle Paul. He really was the man for the hour, wasn't he? There was this unreached world out there, and Paul was the man to take the gospel to it. And the Christian church then needs driven men and women like the Apostle Paul. But then think of Barnabas and his generosity of spirit, as I've called it. And without that, there probably would never have been a driven Apostle Paul to take the gospel to those towns and cities and regions anyway. Because who is it that gives Paul his first break in ministry, as we might say? It's Barnabas, isn't it? Barnabas goes looking for Saul of Tarsus when he's in some backwater. And Barnabas brings him to Antioch in order to teach the new Christians there. And he then, just like with Mark, he sees potential in Saul. And he sees that this man could be encouraged by being given an opportunity there in Antioch. And he sees through the baggage, the off-putting baggage of what's gone on in the past, that Saul has been a persecutor. And he brings Saul to Antioch. And there's this pastoral sensitivity then about the man, without which perhaps Paul's missionary career would never have been launched in the first place. And you see what I'm saying then, that the church needs driven men like Paul, but it also needs pastorally sensitive men like Barnabas. And it needs that crucial variety then, in order that it might function effectively. And it's the same for us today. and here at NREC then, we'll have different dispositions and outlooks, just like Paul and Barnabas did. Some of us deeply conservative, others highly daring. Some of us precise and detailed, others resourceful and creative. Some of us tense and excitable, others laid back and unflappable. And for us too, this may occasionally throw up awkward situations, disagreements like here in Antioch at this point between Paul and Barnabas. But at such times we mustn't wish that we were all just the same and we're all just clones of each other, because this is a healthy variety. It's a crucial variety. If the church is to function properly, we can't be the same. We can't all be Paul's. We can't all be Barnabas's. This is part of a healthy, crucial variety that God has built into his church. So it's a disagreement, not a fight. It's variety, not confusion. But then thirdly, it's beneficial, not disastrous. It's beneficial, not disastrous. So we've analysed Paul and Barnabas' separation then in terms of the principles involved. And we've said it's fine because there was no fighting going on here. And we've said it's good that there's this variety within God's church. But moving on from the principles involved and viewing this through more pragmatic spectacles, isn't it just unfortunate, isn't it damaging, isn't it disastrous that here Paul and Barnabas are breaking up? I mean, this is the first official missionary partnership of the Christian church, and these men, they've established a close working relationship during that first missionary journey. You get a sense of that, by the way, back in chapter 14, again in Lystra there, and you notice how in verse 14 Luke says, when the apostles Barnabas and Paul heard of what the crowd were doing there, sacrificing to them, they tore their garments and rushed out into the crowd, crying out, men, why are you doing these things? And so on. You notice how Luke says Paul and Barnabas cried out these things. Well, it can only have been one of them. I mean, they can't both have said those exact same words, because it goes on for several verses. It must have only been one of them. But Luke says Paul and Barnabas said these things. It's almost as though they're so close in their relationship that when one speaks, both of them speak. Luke can't separate them. And so there's this close relationship, and it's been so successful. They've gone around all those places and new churches have sprung up. There have been so many conversions, and now this distinguished duo is being disassembled. Isn't this sad? Isn't this disastrous that Paul and Barnabas aren't going to be together? Surely no good can come of it. Well, actually, I think Luke intends us to see that good does come of it. So, for one thing then, and this is often pointed out by commentators and preachers, for one thing, we have here a doubling of missionary teams, don't we? It would have just have been Paul and Barnabas going off. Now we have Paul and Silas, and we have Barnabas and Mark. So instead of one missionary team, we have two missionary teams going out. And so there's a multiplication of workers. And the monthly missionary prayer meeting in the church in Antioch suddenly becomes a lot more interesting. There's not just one prayer session for Paul and Barnabas, but now there's one for Barnabas and Mark and one for Paul and Silas. And their missionary board in the foyer of their building suddenly becomes a bit more full because there are two photos and two pieces of string with a drawing pin at the end of them. And so suddenly there are more missionaries out there, and you can see then this is beneficial, not disastrous in that sense. But I think there's a more important way it's beneficial and not disastrous. And it's this. Remember the context here. Remember the big picture. Remember the key juncture we've just got to in the book of Acts, where this huge issue has come up about circumcision. Is circumcision necessary for salvation? And remember how there's been this big meeting in Jerusalem, and there's been this big debate, and there's been this conclusion then that no, circumcision isn't necessary. And now, of course, that conclusion has to be disseminated around the churches of the first century world. And this is the thing. Who better to do that than Paul and Silas? Much better, I think, than Paul and Barnabas. Paul and Barnabas, I mean, it's clear right from the outset of Acts 15 which side of the whole thing they're on. I mean, they're the ones that are raising the issue. They're the ones that are so taken aback and so concerned about people preaching that circumcision is necessary. They're the ones that take the issue to Jerusalem to have a debate in the first place. Paul and Barnabas, everyone knows where they stand on this. And so if they're going around saying, well, you know, circumcision isn't necessary, it's been decided, there might be this question mark, well, are they just here kind of venting their own personal prejudices? But Silas, I mean, he's Jerusalem through and through. He's been sent by the church in Jerusalem to Antioch precisely for that reason, to give a certain sense of respectability to the conclusions. He's one of the Jerusalem conservative brigades. And so when it's he and Paul, the radical evangelist, and Silas, the conservative Jerusalem church member, when it's they going around, as they do, because we read that in the next chapter in verse 4, that they went through the cities and delivered to them for observance the decisions that had been reached by the apostles and elders in Jerusalem, when it's Paul and Silas, it would have come with so much more force and impact than if it were Paul and Barnabas. And as I say, this is a key matter. If the church gets this wrong, then the gospel has gone down the drain. We said that last week. This is a gospel issue. That's what Peter says, isn't it, in Acts 15? The issue here is the grace of the Lord Jesus Christ. Are we saved by grace or are we not? And if then part of the church had gone down a route that circumcision is necessary, then that would have been compromising the very gospel itself. This is a key, key issue. And we can see then how beneficial it is that it's Paul and Silas, not Paul and Barnabas, who go out with this message. And of course, this fact that the whole separation turns out beneficial rather than disastrous, that reminds us of something deeper, doesn't it? That we began our service with this morning, that Jesus is building his church, and that Jesus is masterminding things here, and that Jesus is arranging everything for the best and for the maximum growth of his church and the maximum expansion of the gospel. It's funny, isn't it, how Luke, he never tells us why Mark deserted on that first journey. And it's so tantalizing there in chapter 13, verse 13, that John left them and returned to Jerusalem. And you think, well, Luke, you're just missing an opportunity here. You could give us a great moral lecture here on why Mark deserted and how we mustn't desert from gospel work, and you could really go to town on that. You're missing a trick here, Luke. But I think Luke doesn't much care for the reasons why Mark deserted. What Luke cares about, and what Luke cares that we see, is that Jesus is doing something in all of this. And whatever the reasons for Mark's desertion, it was in Jesus' plan that Mark should desert, that Paul should not take him on the next journey, and that Barnabas, therefore, should not go on the next journey, and that Silas instead should go on the next journey, so that there would be this beautiful balance of Paul and Silas on the second missionary journey. And that's what Luke's interested in from beginning to end in Acts, not all the moral lessons we can learn from how the different characters respond to different situations, but that we see Jesus is building his church. The same Jesus who was so active throughout Luke's first volume, Luke, the third gospel, the same Jesus is no less active now he's in heaven. He's no less active indeed in the work of redemption. It's a new phase now. He's not laying his life down for sinners now. He's done that. but he still is active in the work of redemption, now building his church, now strategizing and masterminding everything. Such a wonderful theme. And of course it continues today. And in all the different details of church life at the local level, all that's happening at the big macro level of Christ's church, in all of it, he's at work. And he is working all things out for the best. So we've seen then, why should we be upbeat? Because it's a disagreement, not a fight. It's variety, not confusion. It's beneficial, not disastrous. But then fourthly and finally, it's reported, not embellished. This is the final reason we should be upbeat. It's reported, not embellished. We've seen then just now that Jesus is at work here. He's masterminding all of this. But you kind of think, well, couldn't Luke have just made that a bit more obvious? Couldn't he have spelt it out a bit more? Okay, we've seen it by probing and by really analysing the passage, we've seen that. But couldn't Luke have just put it on a plate for us? I mean, you just cast your eye into the next passage, or the next chapter rather, and we have stuff there about the Holy Spirit forbidding Paul going places, and about visions, Paul having visions, and all the rest of it. And that all seems quite satisfyingly supernatural. And you think, couldn't Luke just introduce a few supernatural touches here? I mean, it all seems very ordinary, very human, as a disagreement between Paul and Barnabas. We know about disagreements, and it just seems a bit too human. Couldn't Luke just spice it up a bit? But of course, the reason that Luke couldn't spice it up a bit is because Luke feels constrained by the truth. And Luke feels he can only write what actually happened. And there weren't visions here. And there weren't miracles here. And there wasn't some direct special guidance from Jesus here. And so Luke doesn't say there was, because he's constrained by what actually happened. He's reporting. He's not embellishing. And I think passages like this then, where the ordinariness almost takes us aback, they're such precious and important passages to us, because they do remind us then that the biblical writers are trustworthy writers. And when they do tell us about spectacular and supernatural things happening, we can trust them, because they're not introducing supernatural and spectacular details gratuitously. And so, because Luke here clearly is only interested in reporting, not embellishing, we can trust him on more important matters, like the passage we read earlier on this morning, where he tells us a few chapters earlier in his first volume about a man rising from the dead. And we can come to that and we can say, no, this isn't Luke just fabricating. This isn't Luke just making things up. He's not that kind of writer. If he was, we wouldn't have chapter 15, verses 36 to 41. Chapter 15, 36 to 41 show us Luke is interested in accuracy, in reportage. And that's a principle we can take then to Luke 24. This is reportage. And so I'm saying, if you're a Christian this morning, and sometimes you have doubts, as we all do, and sometimes you wonder, and sometimes you think, well, can I really trust the resurrection accounts? And there are all kinds of reasons why the answer is yes, but this is one of them too. That if Luke were the kind of guy who embellished, we would see it certainly at the end of chapter 15 of Acts. And if you're not a Christian, and you think, well, it's all just fairy tales, I would encourage you to think about that. Why then do we have this passage here, which just seems a bit of a mess, and a bit ordinary, a bit lacking? Why do we have it? We have it because these biblical writers were constrained by the truth. And Luke was as constrained by the truth in chapter 24 of his gospel as he was here in Acts 15. Consider again the possibility that Jesus really did rise from the dead, and consider all the implications of that for your life and your eternity this morning. Amen.